The Defense Department is inching closer to a second round of spending cuts. It could be up to $600 billion over 10 years. That would be part of the sequestration that Congress may consider. But one way or the other, the Defense Department is going to start feeling the pinch in some respect. Travis Sharp is a defense analyst at the Center for New American Security. He joins us now with his read on how DOD might deal with further trimming. Good morning, Mr. Sharp.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Congressman Norm Dix seems to think there will be a deal to handle sequestration. How likely is that?
Well, a lot of it's going to depend on what happens next week. Next Thursday, the Pentagon is planning to release the first details about its fiscal year 2013 budget request. I think the Pentagon anticipates that releasing some of those details will spur Congress into action. Up until this point, the conversation about defense budget cuts has been big abstract numbers, $500 billion, $1 trillion. Those are hard things for lawmakers to conceptualize. But once you get down into the specific line items and you're talking about cutting programs which will impact jobs back in their home states and districts, then I think you're going to see lawmakers much more motivated to try to reach some type of agreement about sequestration.
And we can speculate all day long, and we have been actually, about what the likelihood of that is. But let's put that aside and look at the defense budget itself, something you've done a lot of. And where do you think the potential places are that DOD could trim more or less if it had to?
Well, there's several categories. First of all, the level of cuts that we're looking at right now, even if sequestration doesn't occur, is going to require the Pentagon to make some cuts to some major programs, major combat capabilities. This would include things like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, the size of the Army and the Marine Corps, or major naval shipbuilding programs. A second category is personnel pay and benefits. That is a highly sensitive category of spending because we're still in the middle of a war, so any changes that you make to personnel pay could affect morale among those who are serving on the front lines. So it's an incredibly sensitive issue that politicians and lawmakers are going to be very wary about making significant changes to. The third category, and the one that doesn't get talked about quite as much, is the Pentagon's business practices. This is the day-to-day activities that the Pentagon undertakes in order to support the warfighters who are out defending the nation. And it's not really that sexy to talk about this category of spending. It doesn't really motivate lawmakers to take action to stop sequestration from occurring. But I think that there is a lot of reform that can be done to business practices in order to save money over the next 10 years.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, my question for you was, where's the fat? Where do you think the Pentagon could trim its budget?
I mean, there's just some everyday activities that the Pentagon does that it could probably do more efficiently. For example, some of the facilities maintenance things that the Pentagon does on a daily basis, like trimming grass, maintaining buildings, doing repairs. A lot of times, each of the military services, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force, will have their own separate way of doing those types of things. But I think one thing that you could do is adopt what we call a purple standard of support, which basically means whichever of the services is undertaking that activity most efficiently, you mandate that as the proper procedure, and then you require all of the services to do it that way. If you do that with lots of different activities that the Pentagon does, before you know it, you've saved some real money.
We're speaking with Travis Sharp. He's a defense analyst at the Center for a New American Security. Now, presumably, if you fixed business processes like procurement, then that would lower the cost of some of those other elements you mentioned, like the weapon systems. So looking at the fighters and so forth and these different programs, that is a joint effort, and yet it's still way out of control on cost standpoint. So what did they not do jointly that they could have maybe to get that one under control?
Well, the Joint Strike Fighter, to use that as an example, is an incredibly ambitious technological effort. It's also a multinational procurement program. The United States has gotten several international partners to join in the development and procurement of the aircraft. One of the problems that we're facing now in the U.S. military is that we don't procure major weapon systems that often. These big programs only come around every 10, maybe 20 years. So there is a sort of a mindset that you have to try to put everything technologically possible into every new system because you're not going to get another chance at it for 20 years. So I think that there has been some sort of there's been a push to try to maximize the amount of technological advancement that we can get into each program. And while that is a good thing because technology is an advantage for the U.S. military, I think it's also contributed to some of the delays and the cost overruns that we continue to see in these major weapons programs.
And looking at the issue of superiority, because that's really what the ultimate goal is of all of this, is to come out still being superior. There seems to be a growing disagreement. We had an analyst on yesterday that said even if we get rid of a carrier fleet and we cut back on troops, we still have so much more than everybody else that we can meet any challenge. Other people say we're hollowing out the military. What, in your opinion, is actually going on?
Well, I think comparing the U.S. military to other militaries around the world can be a useful exercise in one regard, which is the United States has long believed that it should try to maintain a degree of primacy in the world, essentially that it should remain the largest and most powerful military because that allows us to support all of our allies around the world and to sort of uphold international institutions and things like that. So I think in that regard, it is a useful way of measuring whether or not our military is meeting our grand strategic requirements. However, in terms of telling us how much we should be spending on defense, I think that comparing our spending to the spending of other countries is not particularly useful because the United States military does far more than any other military around the world. And the only real way to measure how big our defense budget should be is to ask, what do you want the military to do, how much does it cost, and how much risk are you willing to assume? Those are hard questions, and they're not particularly suited for the sort of polemics that tend to surround this issue. But at the end of the day, those are the questions that you have to answer to determine how much we should spend on defense.
In your opinion, is anyone asking those questions right now?
Some people are. I think that the Pentagon's new strategic guidance that came out a couple weeks ago actually started to move in some different directions than we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years. However, the Pentagon is working in a very uncertain budgetary environment, and the strategic guidance, while I think it offered some encouraging ends about where geographically the United States military should focus its efforts, it didn't provide a lot of detail about how it was actually going to do that. So I think that there's a lot more work to be done in these areas. Unfortunately, with the campaigns the way they are and coming up on a presidential election, I'm afraid that a lot of this is just going to fall into sort of campaign sound bites, and the American people are going to miss out on the debate that they really deserve and need.
Yeah, and just not to put it in too brutal terms, but suppose Iran spilled out of its shell with nuclear weapons and North Korea decided to overrun some parts of the world it's near with its nuclear weapons and its big army. The question, I guess, is if we can't take on those threats, who can backstop the United States?
Right, and the simple answer is nobody. Nobody can deal with those types of major security challenges except the United States. And the Pentagon has adopted a policy that it calls reversibility, which basically means if we make cuts in some of our capabilities, we want to do it in such a way that we can reverse them quickly if we find ourselves in a crisis. And that is the right policy, I think. I've recommended a similar course of action. However, I think it's good to be clear that that does entail more risk, because when the crisis erupts in the immediate aftermath, you are not as ready and as prepared to deal with the challenge as you would have been if you would have maintained a larger and more capable military. So there are some serious trade-offs that we need to be talking about on these issues.
Travis Sharp is a defense analyst at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.